So our next speaker was unable to attend APHA this year, but she has provided a narrated presentation that I will be starting up. So Devaki Nambiar received her doctorate in public health from Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, examining social production of HIV/AIDS-related stigma in India. A former Fulbright and NIH scholar, her research applies critical theory and mixed methods to understand the social determinants of health and health systems governance in resource-poor settings. Dr. Nambiar has conducted research in Bangladesh, Bhutan, India, Myanmar, Tanzania, Thailand, and Vietnam.
Good afternoon, everyone. Greetings from Delhi. I'm sorry I can't be there for the session, but thanks to Dr. Bailey, Dr. Cubbin, and Dr. Krieger, I'm in a position to share some of my reflections from ongoing work in India, specifically in Kerala, that furnish a view on health equity in all policies. This setup is already complicated, technologically speaking, so I apologize, I'm not online. My request is that if you have questions or want to take this conversation further, do please email me. Statistics tell stories. They are techno-representations endowed with complex political and cultural histories. One should be able to analyze counting in terms of its political consequences, the way in which it reflects the crafting of subjectivities, the shaping of culture, and the construction of social power. These words, familiar to many of us, are from Arturo Escobar's classical work, Encountering Development. They form the rationale behind this paper that draws from the numbers and statistics gleaned from our ongoing research on health equity in all policies at the district level in Kerala, where politics prefigure data profoundly. This short presentation has two goals. First, I aim to decenter and problematize the notion of good health at low cost, a lens, though well-intentioned, that circumscribes our understanding of health and what health reform was about in the state of Kerala. Second, I will sketch out for you the very humbling lessons of our attempt to historicize data gathered on health and its social determinants at the district level in Palakkad, Kerala. The idea of a Kerala model for health and social welfare was popularized by the Rockefeller Foundation in its 1985 publication, Good Health at Low Cost. You can see a record of the meeting about the corresponding report held at Bellagio back in 1985. As pointed out in this report, Kerala, a small state at the southern tip of India, had unexpectedly low levels of mortality and high life expectancy. There was much ado about this by Rockefeller and many others. It took me some years to realize that the very question being asked by good health at low cost was perhaps unnecessarily narrow. The Kerala model wasn't about health at low cost. It was about the entitlement of all Keralites, especially women, to health, education, land reform, and freedom from feudal tyranny. It was about state responsibility for the rights and welfare of the people, at whatever cost. As argued by Professor Raman Kutty, there never was a Kerala model in health, in the sense that there was no conscious policy effort to create an equitable health system which would offer health security to all. I continue to quote, "What was described as the Kerala model in health is a demographic transition that occurred faster than in many other parts of the world, bringing down death and birth rates within the span of a single generation. This was the result of a political environment that emphasized rights and a policy thrust that ensured rights in education and in health. Thus, health development is generally attributed to intersectoral factors such as the spread of education, political awareness, development of road networks and transportation, and social movements." Jean Drez and Amartya Sen, writing in the 1990s about the Kerala model, pointed out the contributions of various factors by turning to history. Missionary activity linked to education and nutrition, welfarist government policy in the erstwhile princely states, the pervasive influence of the matrilineal system, anti-caste social reform, mass political movements led by the Communist Party from the 30s, and the communist governments that came to power in the state in 1957, 1967, 1980, and 1987. When the state of Kerala was established in 1956, the Communist Party was the only political organization in the state with a program for socioeconomic and political change. They point out, and I quote, "Despite its relatively short periods in the leadership of the government of the state, the left in Kerala has mobilized the people for kinds of social change unprecedented in the rest of the country." But this, of course, is only part of the story. At precisely the time the Kerala model was being lauded, it was under threat. Beginning in 1985, the World Bank began making its forays into Kerala, more on that shortly, followed soon by the Asian Development Bank. On conditions of loans received from the Asian Development Bank, Kerala dropped its spending on health precipitously. As we can see from the blue line here, expenditures on health and family welfare as a proportion of state GDP halved between 1983 and post-reform in 2005-06. You can see up top that while the allocation was increasing annually at a low rate, 0.29% in the initial years through the 1980s, it began to drop by almost 2% annually the 1990s onwards. At the same time, we see massive increases in health expenditure per capita in the red bars below. So more and more spending, but less and less by the government. Alarm bells are now ringing in Kerala over the escalating privatization and medicalization of the health system. 2014 data shows that both males and females in Kerala are almost doubly likely to go to a private doctor or hospital than to go to a public health center or hospital for their most recent ailment. Further, only 1 in 10 people, the first two bars on the left, is seeking care at primary level facilities like primary health centers and dispensaries in the public sector. There is a clear preference for hospital-based care, both in the public and private sectors. This is what we call the inverse law, of course, of healthcare. When a team revisited good health at low cost in 2013, therefore, Kerala could no longer be counted a success story. Rather, it was the neighboring state of Tamil Nadu that was highlighted. Ironically, furthermore, it was the very fact that costs had escalated in Kerala that booted it from the running. Even as a sample survey conducted but a year after this report found that hospitalization costs are higher in the state of Tamil Nadu as compared to Kerala on in average terms, driven by urban expenses. So here you can see that Tamil Nadu certainly outpaces Kerala in terms of costs in urban areas, though costs in rural areas are higher in Kerala. And the averages you can also see here. Regardless, Kerala now bears the ignominy of poor health at escalating cost. It is also important, critical even, to note that in 2005-2006, health expenses pushed 3.8% of rural dwellers in Kerala and 4.5% of urban dwellers below the poverty line. The equity hallmarks of the Kerala model of accessible and quality health protection and promotion publicly provided along with education and social security and other public services and rights are now artifacts of nostalgia and utopia. The alarming data showing people falling into poverty in this heavily tertiarized, privatized system is evident not just in Kerala, but globally. This has motivated a familiar set of players, including Rockefeller, to build global momentum around universal health coverage, or UHC. The idea here is making sure all populations, that's the base of the cube at the bottom, receive a comprehensive range of services, that's the width of the cube, and at the same time are assured financial risk protection, shown here as the height of the cube. Elsewhere, I and others have posited the problematic conceptualization of UHC in an insurance framework, while others have taken issue with the general vagueness of this concept. But ambiguity may be fertile ground for change. In India, a high-level expert group convened by our planning commission made clear in 2011 that UHC was impossible without action on social determinants of health. They in fact acknowledged this in the very definition of universal health coverage for the country. The idea was to underscore the necessity of a broader transformation. Soon after, Kerala was among the first Indian states to act on implementing UHC. We at PHFI were honored to receive an opportunity to think not just about the philosophy or polemics of UHC, but rather its mechanics and functioning at the district level. Rather than carry out an extensive and time-consuming exercise of primary data collection, we decided to take stock of what data actually already exists and what it is telling us. Over 8 months, a 6-person team led by a seasoned advisor, collected and analyzed over 500 indicators for the year 2013-14 from over 60 sources. We worked closely with state and district officials and only with their concurrence at each step. The pictures here are of various sets of consultations with these officials across the district. While the predominant emphasis in this project was to look at the UHC cube of population, service and financial risk protection coverage, we integrated and interpolated this into an analysis of health equity in, I couldn't say all, but most policies. So we looked at service coverage not only in health, but also outside the health sector, including services that were universal or linked to public goods. I highlight just the determinants here, but we obviously also looked at the health sector. So you see here services at the community level, like roads, pollution control at both household, and then also in the middle, services at both community and household levels, like power and sanitation, and household and individual specific goods like housing, drinking, water, education, employment, and so on. So in a sense, we tried to make service coverage a proxy for horizontal equity, equal access to health and social determinants for all. Looking at the work of leading social scientists in the States and critiques of the Kerala model, we were mindful that, quote, rather than rely upon broad development indicators, what we need are closer inquiries into specific sites of disadvantage. We also examined what kinds of programs in health and its determinants across sectors existed for special populations, like the elderly, caste minorities, indigenous persons, the differently abled, those in tenuous occupations in the state like fishing, migrant labor, as well as survivors of violence. Roughly speaking, population coverage then was used as a proxy for horizontal equity to each group as per special need. For want of time, I will focus on service coverage in one of the two districts where we worked. Drawing from insurance claim data for a scheme covering those below or close to the state poverty line in 2013 and 14, we found that waterborne communicable diseases stand out in Palakkad district. There were 640 claims of urinary tract infections and over 500 claims made for inpatient care for dengue, followed by 224 cases of inpatient care for diarrhea, all in 1 year, in a district of just 2.8 million. Data also showed that 18% of the population had suffered from a waterborne illness in the same year. Disease surveillance data lists diarrhea and dysentery as the fourth most common reported ailments, and even in private hospitals, diarrhea is in the top 10 most common conditions patients present with. Looking upstream, we found that less than 40% of households in Palakkad had an improved water source. Only about 44% of government and government-aided schools had latrines in their premises. Open defecation was reported by 9.4% of households. That's almost 1 in 10. Two-thirds of tested water sources in this district had coliform contamination. Sewage treatment does not exist. No other indicators on solid waste generation, treatment and service coverage were even available, even though Kerala's highly decentralized local government authorities have extensive records for most indicators. Palakkad also has vast tracts of flood and landslide-prone areas, which only heighten the propensity for this kind of morbidity. Our first response was, water and sanitation in Palakkad have been neglected. That's the problem. But as we soon learned, the problem was somewhat the converse. The very same year that Good Health at Low Cost came out, 1985, the World Bank approved the Kerala Water Supply and Sanitation Project, aimed to strengthen the newly formed Kerala Water Authority, whose mandate was to provide piped water supply systems and introduce low-cost on-site sanitation pilot programs in rural areas. This focus was a major preoccupation of the bank and various other donors at the halfway point of the International Water Supply and Sanitation Decade, 1981 through 1990. The tenets of its approach are enshrined in the 1999 Cochin Declaration, which calls for demand responsiveness of water-related services, changing the role of the government from provider of water to facilitator of access, something we know has also happened in the health sector. Also, establishing financial viability as a key parameter of water supply services rather than water supply indicators themselves, calling for water resource management, including rain harvesting and such like, and similar provisions. A little over $83 million US was spent over a period of roughly a decade. Of course, it should be mentioned that the model, as replicated elsewhere in the world, involved citizens bearing a proportion of the cost as well. As elsewhere, a greater skew of cost has been borne proportionately by lower income groups, something in the order of 4.3%, as compared to upper income groups, something in the order of 0.3%. The plan was, after all, to monetize water as a resource. A recent evaluation of the project points out, and I replicate the comments here, quote, M&E Design paid scant attention to monitoring the level of service delivery in terms of volumes and quality of water supplied to households and household time savings. Similarly, there were no measures to systematically monitor the environmental impact of expanding latrine coverage and community garbage bins. Now, this is already curious for a program called Water Supply and Sanitation, though it is also perplexing that no health outcomes were assessed either. Data are not available for Palakkad specifically, but throughout bank intervention areas, targets for hardware construction or upgradation of toilets were surpassed. However, targets for building latrines in schools and efforts to improve drainage were not. About 20% of the project areas eliminated open defecation in 2008, going up to 76% by 2012. This increase, though, was likely brought about by various other programs concurrently underway by UNICEF and the state government. Still, even after all this, one in four people roughly was defecating in the open in intervention areas of this project. You'll recall that we, according to 2011 census data, gathered around the same time, in Palakkad the figure is just under one in 10 persons. So the district is better off than the project intervention areas. There are other stories stirring behind these statistics as well. Some may be aware of the anti-Coca-Cola struggles that motivated local protest by caste minority and indigenous populations that were resident in Plachimada, Palakkad. Not only had Coca-Cola, the presence of the Coca-Cola factory, that is, caused acute water shortages in the area through groundwater mining for the 2 years of its existence, there was also evidence of untreated effluent affecting water quality. In what ultimately became a rare example of what Ravi Raman calls transverse solidarity, public and private institutions supported local protesters, finding not only hardness, salinity, and alkalinity in the groundwater, but also levels of chlorides and sulfides higher than WHO permissible limits. Viewing the evidence, India's Supreme Court found Coca-Cola to be in violation of the country's hazardous waste rules, and the factory was shut down in 2002. Reparation struggles continue. Meanwhile, various evaluations have found that waterborne illnesses remain a scourge. A 2006 survey by an affiliate of the People's Health Movement found that 70% of households surveyed in the state report mosquitoes as their greatest health hazard. Over 8,000 dengue cases were confirmed in the state of Kerala in 2013, although suspected cases were close to 25,000. In June, the figure of suspected dengue cases in Kerala was slightly over 4,000. Just 2 weeks ago, a member of our team was laid up for a week with her second bout of dengue. We are at a somewhat strange crossroad now. The bank project has ended, but left in its wake a situation where illness burdens from waterborne diseases remain, and in the state more broadly, the Kerala model has elided over time. Even the much lauded strength of people's movements is being structurally vitiated. As Devika points out, quote, given the total withdrawal of militant leftist evocation of state welfare as a people's right, characteristic of the mid-20th century, it is perceived increasingly as a dole, a handout from above, from the state or political party. So, at this juncture, we view with cautious optimism the recent launch of a public health protection agency in Kerala, an attempt to instantiate a health in all policies kind of framework in the state. At the launch symposium a year ago, the Chief Minister started his comments by saying, and I quote, in spite of large-scale intervention, epidemics during the monsoon season are a regular feature which have increased in recent years, end quote. There is an appreciation of the challenge and the fact that this requires, as it always has, not just large, but convergent intervention involving the collaboration of the health, rural development, local government, social justice, and other departments. We at PHFI have been asked to help with creating an observatory as part of the agency. This is our chance to link assessments to actual action on health equity in all policies and also to make sure the lessons of the stories behind the statistics we collate are not left unheeded. It is a difficult, humbling task, inflected by a complex history. And onward we go. Thank you.